You're listening to a Rhythms podcast from Bluesfest 2012, produced by the media students of Southern Cross University.
Thank you all coming to the Cavern Bar stage. This is our last day of Q&As, obviously. We've had some great guests over the weekend, but I have to say that Justin Townsell is a definite favourite of Rhythms magazine, so we're really happy to have him on stage, and thank you for sharing your time with us today.
Yeah, glad to be here.
We've been very fortunate to see a lot of you in Australia over the, I think it's been, what, four tours in almost as many years, has it?
I think it's actually like six.
Wow.
Six tours in about, I guess it's been about 3.5 years or something like that. I started coming down and it's just become one of my, it's definitely without question my favorite place to tour. And so I've been starting the last three records, I've started the tours here because I just find it to be a relaxing way to start a tour.
We're not guinea pigs, eh? If you play a bad show, it doesn't get to the rest of the world.
I try not to play bad shows anywhere. Yeah. It happens sometimes, though.
Well, it's interesting. Actually, I remember when I first interviewed you back for the first couple of releases, you were saying then that you found you were sort of better understood and appreciated in Europe than you were back at home.
Yeah,
and
I think that, well, I made a conscious decision to kind of, do what I could to change that on the last record. And with Harlem River Blues, it kind of got the foot in the door in some places that my last records didn't. And so I didn't go to Europe really last year. I did one run there but I did two. I came to Australia twice and then just toured like crazy in the States trying to get it because,
yep.
I mean, it's great to make a living in Europe and it's great to do good in Europe and great to do good in Australia, but it's also, that's not going to put my kids through college when I eventually have them. Maybe.
Well, I notice you are basically going straight from here to a headline tour in the US, aren't you?
Yeah.
So that's...
Yeah, it's record launch usually, I mean, it's a little easier. We do have a few days between getting back home and actually going out on the road where, a year ago or so, I would be going straight back and like landing and making a record or going in to make a record or going out on the road immediately.
But things are improving for you in the States. You making some headway?
Yeah, it has. Yeah. It's gotten, I'm playing, bigger rooms, and I'm touring on a bus finally, and it's changed, and it's good because I've been in the bus in a van for 13 years.
Yeah, right.
It's a long time for my height in a van.
Well, without going into too many sordid details, I mean, perhaps you can give us an idea how you sort of finally succumbed to the, the inevitable destiny of your names, Towns and Earl. I mean, because I remember you telling me it was never your original plan to be a singer-songwriter, was it?
Oh, no, I was going to be when I was a kid, I played soccer. That was my obsession. I thought I wanted to be a professional soccer player. And I avoided the music business with, I tried to avoid it. Which was very easy to do until, I think that with Kurt Cobain, I kind of started getting into music but then I discovered Lead Belly and Woody Guthrie, and then I discovered something for the first time that kind of talked like I did and didn't need to be overcomplicated or anything like that. And it really turned me on, and I've kind of never looked back since.
Yeah. Yeah. But, I mean, having said that, you did, before you started releasing music under your own name, you had already put in a lot of hard yards, hadn't you? Probably more than most people are aware with, the Swindlers and the Distributors and playing in Steve Earle's band, so you weren't exactly green by the time you put out your first release, were you?
No, I wasn't. I mean, I think I had a chance very early in my career when I was about 18 years old. I was signed to a record label, and I basically just was too messed up, and the record label decided that they already had one artist that was kind of out of control at the time, and they didn't need another one, and so they dropped me, and it took the next, it took the next, 7 years for me to kind of clean up my act enough to where, if I had made a record when I was 18, my first record couldn't have been like The Good Life, and I definitely couldn't have followed it with Midnight at the Movies because I just wasn't ready to do anything like that yet. Yeah. I was I would have been jumping the gun. And I'm kind of glad I had a lot of, you know, problems with the drugs and alcohol and all that stuff early on, but it stopped me from, you know, putting out a record prematurely. And, you know, I didn't put out a record till I was 25, I think, you know, somewhere around there. So it definitely, all the hard times had their perks, I guess.
Well, you obviously had a clear idea of what you wanted to do then with your music, and has that changed much over the years since you've actually taken it on as a career?
No, I mean, I'm still a very much like, you know, when we went in to make the newest record, nothing's going to change the way you feel about me now. I told everybody that I wanted to make a, you know, a kind of soul-influenced record. I wanted to record it live, and so we, you know, this and you know, so that's like, and it's not something that a lot of people take on these days, is trying to record live with a 12 to 13 piece band. It gets kind of difficult, but it's like I always write my records to be records. I actually put the songs on the new record in the sequence that I wrote them in, and we recorded them in that sequence, and then we, and you know, so my records are very, I mean, everything is on purpose.
Yeah, right.
On my records, there's very few, I don't go in guessing what's going to happen very much. I've found out some players that make it very solid, where I can walk in and speak my Greek to them, and they know how to turn it into math.
We had Betty Levette in here the other day talking about making records, and she said something which I'm sure you can concur with. You know, she refuses to take more than 5 days to make a record.
Yeah, I've never. I think the longest we took was, I think Harlem River Blues was like, took 6 days, and I was also drinking very heavily during that period, and it was not a, it was, but we still managed to do it in 6 days. I think everything else was done, and we tracked the new record in 4 days. You know, Good Life was tracked, mixed, and mastered in 5 days.
Yeah, right.
I remember that, but yeah, I don't like to sit.
Yeah,
I see people taking a month to make a record, and I just think like why? Like, I mean, I don't see there any point in stepping into the studio until I have a very clear cut idea of what I'm going after, because I can get bored really fast, and I think that it's also, I can, you know, I gotta be able to, if I work fast, then I don't lose my focus. If we take too long, then I'm not even gonna want to make the same record if we have to wait a month, you know. I'll have a new idea by then, and that's how you end up making atrocious, disjointed records, I think, you know. Yeah. I have to be careful.
Well, yeah, going back to that point of when you started to focus on writing your own songs and putting out your own records, you don't seem like a guy that does things by halves. You obviously threw yourself into it, because it's been, you'd average nearly a record a year since then, huh?
Yeah. I think that it's, you know, I'm very convinced that, like, I'm not a, what people would call a prolific writer. I write about 10 to 12 songs a year.
Yep.
All that it takes to make a record, because I do think that, you know, I mean, I'm only going to get so many, you know, and I want to space them out, because I mean, I've seen even my favorite songwriters that have done things that I think are amazing in the past doing terrible things to these days, and I just, you know, I don't want to overdo it, and you know, I see a lot of albums coming out these days where if somebody took all the good ideas from all the songs and put them into one song, then they'd have a great song. But instead you have like a lot of like one-liners and like this little, it's like, oh, I love this part. It's like, you know, you don't love the song. And I'm just trying to, I'm trying to make records that are like Springsteen made them early on. He made a conscious decision with Born to Run that he was going to make it was a loose concept record. He kind of found a new place in his chest to sing, and that's where you start getting the boss. That's where the boss comes from, and his records started reflecting growing up in Jersey and working in Jersey and things like that, more than like the early records that he made, where it was more kind of just spindly, wispy kind of rock, you know, and that didn't really have any good meaning or intention. You know, he changed, and so I kind of go on that. I try to make records that that my records are concept records, but not in the way that like Redheaded Stranger or Stages and Phases is. It's more like a loose concept.
Yeah.
It's not exactly telling a storyline, but they all get at the same thing.
No, that's interesting though, because I think you said on stage the other day that there's a song on this record that you wrote when you were a teenager, Maria, I think. So you're still drawing from that.
Yeah. You know. Well, I think that, I wrote a lot of songs. I wrote a lot of songs when I was a teenager, and some of them survived, you know, like to go on records. On all my records, there's at least one or two of the older songs that I wrote, like Halfway to Jackson on, what was that, on Midnight at the Movies, I think. I wrote that when I was 15 years old. So that was just like one of the ones that just survived that period. I wrote, on the new record, I wrote Maria when I was 18 or 19, and same with Lower East Side.
Yeah.
But it was, so I think it's good to have that kind of, good to have those to look at and kind of, you know, work with and add in there. Because, I mean, it's a lot of pressure on making records.
Yeah.
I mean, it is. It's like I can see how it crushes some people and makes them total weirdos. That
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
people get weird. Like, there's a lot of older musicians that are very, you can't look Dylan in the eyes backstage. You know, that's always said if you're backstage with Dylan. And I can understand why after 40 years of people staring at you, you probably want a break.
Well, but that's that, you know. So that, it was interesting. Betty had this long discussion the other day, Betty Levitt, about songwriters should be songwriters and singers should be singers, and only rarely should you be both. But do you consider that there's, you know, you were writing good songs at a very early age? Do you sort of subscribe to the theory that you have to have some innate sort of God-given ability?
Yeah. I mean, I think that there's a large part of being a songwriter that can be taught and has to be taught,
yep.
and you have to be open to learning, I think. But I do think that there is, I don't think that it's like anything that's necessarily like a songwriter gene. I think that it's just that you just kind of, it's about your point of view.
Yep.
Some people just have a different point of view, but unfortunately, a lot of people have a really dull point of view of life, and if you have a dull point of view, then you're not going to make a good songwriter, because I mean, who the hell wants to see it through your eyes? You know? And so it just depends on, I think that a good songwriter has to have a kind of a unique point of view of life, and has to have, you know, I think that has to, you have to be open to, anytime a songwriter says I have arrived, they're screwed. I think that that's like, you always have to keep your mind open to learning and you keep reading. Like, I think that songwriters have to read a lot. I mean, because if you don't put anything in, nothing's going to come out that's worth a shit.
Yeah. Yeah. I was thinking the other day, you've got a lot to thank all your ex-girlfriends for. You wouldn't have any good songs.
Yeah, it's like, well, I think that that's the other thing that I find in songwriting that people get, is that like, just because it's an average everyday thing doesn't mean that it's a dull thing. I mean, it's like you still have to kind of write at a good reading level that everybody can, you know, everybody can understand, and you do have to kind of make sure that you're doing something like to help people relate, you know?
Yeah.
I don't like, I like to write my songs like a thesis, to where it's like a hard beginning, middle, and end, using only the most important information. Like, if I've already given you like blue eyes on a girl, I don't need to give you red lips and what color her dress is.
Yeah.
Leave that to the people, leave that for the imagination of the listener, and just give them the basics.
Yeah. I think the song that most epitomises that for me, and it's still, my jaw drops every time I hear it, I have to say, is that Mama's Eyes song. And you know, it's so concise, and the turnaround at the end, and it's sort of so personal. I mean, is that a sort of a bit of a watershed moment for you, writing a song like that?
It was definitely one of the moments where I kind of, when I finished writing that, I was a little, definitely more excited than other things that I've written. I think that it took me a little while. I got the first, like, the opening lines, and kind of let it sit for a few months, and then And then one day just kind of went after it. And I, you know, I think that it's like, not everybody can relate to like what, like people can relate to, like everybody's scared of turning into their mother or father, you know, but everybody also probably has most people have a very deep love for their mother and father, even if they weren't the best mother and father, you know? And so it was a feeling and an emotion that's very real to most people that you could put out there, you know? And that's a good example, I think, of putting out, like, I write about the emotions and the feelings that come with things, not the results. Because, you know, everybody can kind of relate to having, you know, some issue with parents, but not everybody can relate to banging dope over it, you know? So you just leave out the results.
Yeah.
Just write about the cause.
Yeah.
Well, I'd love to talk, if it's not too boring, without getting too guitar geeky. Your guitar technique, obviously you spent a long time on that, and I'd like to know, I mean, I still have educated musician friends who can't believe that you do what you're doing without a loop pedal, but that sort of right-handed three-prong attack.
Yeah.
Where did you sort of, you know, where did you pick that up and how did you develop it?
I picked it up from watching, it started with watching banjo
yep.
players play clawhammer banjo,
yep.
and how much ground they were able to cover. They were percussive, melodic, and like percussive and melodic at the same time, just
yeah.
back and forth. And that was really kind of, I was always kind of fascinated by that. But then when I think I was about 16 when I met a guy named Malcolm Holcomb, who is an American songwriter from North Carolina, who is just like one of, not only one of the best songwriters I've ever heard, and but one of the most amazing guitar players. And he played with this style where he kind of held his hand about like this, like a claw, which is, and basically he picked with all his fingers, like came up like classical style, and I'm not really good with all of them, so. I kind of hook these, my thumb is like this, and these stay curved like that.
Yeah.
And it's so, and I leave this finger free to pick.
Yep.
In the middle. And so it's like, as you're going down, I'm catching the three high strings with these fingers, the low strings with my thumb, and then leaving this in the middle to pick
yep.
it up. But, and then you think of it like piano. Think
yep.
of this is your left hand. This is your right hand right here. And so you're done, like you're dun 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 dun. You're able to get that kind of thing going, and that's what it is. It's just kind of thinking. I kind of started thinking of guitar more like piano, like more of a piano rhythm than your kind of typical guitar rhythm. And it was a horrible mess for a really long time.
Yeah.
I mean, it was like I never knew what was going to happen. But I, you know, over the years, I've kind of gotten it a little. I've gotten it narrowed down to more what works. And I have my whole career. I've been accused of using loops and things like that.
Yeah,
I mean,
right.
And I'm a lot like. I feel like all the Dap King boys feel. You know, it's like I have an engineer who works for me on all my records, and I never, even though I've produced my last two, I never touch, especially a computer, but nothing that's you know, needs to work for the process, because I'm one of those people that went for some reason when I touch anything that's not old and analog, and it just explodes. It just goes. It says does not compute. and I don't need things to compute to make music, you know. So I like to just leave that to Abner.
All right. Well, finally, let's just talk about. I'd love to talk about the development of your voice, because. I think you told Brian in our interview there that you sort of made a deliberate effort to sing a bit more softly on the new record, and it seems that you're bringing that to the stage from what I saw the other day.
Yeah, I think, you know, I found that I was, for this record, I definitely kind of consciously found a softer place to sing from that didn't, I used to sing from about right here, and so I just kind of started singing from down here, which has been giving me a little bit better of a little bit more push and a little bit more control. I started using in-ear monitors too because of my stage volume was getting really loud, and so now my stage volume's a lot quieter. I can hear everything that I'm doing, yeah. So it gives me a little bit more the ability to be a little more dynamic on the microphone and let the microphone do some work instead of, you know, I used to use these big, large diaphragm microphones, and I'd just put them here and sing from a foot off of them.
Yeah, I remember that.
You know, and it would just cut over the top, but it's like, yeah. You don't got to sing that hard, you know, number one. And I think that this record kind of needed a softer, a little bit softer of a touch than my previous records, because this is definitely the most mellow record I've made.
Yeah, but the other thing is, you were talking about Springsteen finding a place to sing from, and I'm sure, you know, some of your heroes, like, you know, the George Jones and your Webb Pierce and your Johnny Cash, that they all don't sound like they're singing. They sound like they're talking to you, pretty much. You know,
yeah.
They're using their natural voice.
Yeah, and I think that was kind of a thing that I had for a long time been singing, like, a lot of, you know, I grew up with honky-tonk and bluegrass, playing honky-tonk and bluegrass a lot of times, and so I had this really high nasal idea of what vocals were, and I think that I just kind of dropped I kind of decided that for this record, I just like kind of wanted to drop the nasal thing, and yeah, get back more to just like the natural tone of my voice,
yeah.
and you know, and I've found that it's like, you know, I don't come off stage with my throat doesn't hurt anymore,
yeah, right.
And I've never had many problems with my voice, but now I really don't. It's not getting ragged at all, and I think that it helps put the songs across a little better when you're not just like one volume all the damn time,
yeah,
and
yeah.
You can use a little texture and you know, and just bring and be able to reel it in and let it loose whenever you want. You know?
Yeah, cool. Well, tell me, we sort of spoke before about your guitar playing, and you are pretty much almost able to make the sound of a whole band with just your guitar, but you have started touring with a full band in the US. What does that sort of bring to you personally? What does that do for you personally?
Well, I tell you, it's my guitar style, especially like when I'm playing solo. I mean, usually, like, one thing that the band has brought to me is, like, usually by now in a tour, I have like these blood blisters across my cuticles, and
yeah.
I get done with shows every night, and like my hands, like, I can't even put my hand in my pocket to get, you know, to get my wallet out or anything like that. You know, and I just kind of got to I was kind of worried about when the band, like getting a band, because I had been in control of the rhythm and the beat and everything. The tempo was my job for so long, and now it's up to a drummer and a bass player, and I have to kind of get in with them. I didn't want my band to be like a singer-songwriter, like a band backing a singer-songwriter.
Yep.
You know, where it's just like, you know, me just playing whatever the hell I want, and they just got to fit in how they get in. You know, I wanted it to be like a band, because my favorite band, like, I want it to be like Booker T and the MGs. I want it to be like a band. Everybody has a part, and everybody plays it. So I haven't been, it's given me a chance to step back and play. I still play with my hand and in the same style, but I just play a lot less because I play a part now. You know, that has to fit in with the band instead of, you know, just blazing through the songs,
yeah.
You know, and it's a very different way of doing things, and I was very uncomfortable with at first, but it's something that I've settled back into, and now I love it. It's because it gives me, once again, it gives me another chance. It gives me the chance to be, just like on the vocals, be a little more dynamic with the way that I play guitar, because I'm not having to keep everybody's attention all on my own the whole time, which can be, it can be difficult, you know?
Yeah. It can also be riveting.
Yeah. I mean, and well, that's why, I mean, I will always have a solo section in my shows.
Yeah, right.
I mean, I have to keep that practice up, and I will always do solo tours also.
Yeah, right.
Because I, you know, that's where I started, and I think there's, you know, if I get away from that, then that's the start down the road to trouble. You know, so, you know, I think that it's very important for me to go to do the solo shows and keep them up
That
all the
said,
time.
Could you see yourself doing a band record one day? It'd be an interesting development for you, you know.
I will say that, like, I could probably, like, maybe like a side project, but I could never do anything where anybody else had say in it. God, I just can't. My records are my records and my tours are they are a stone cold dictatorship. And this ain't no democracy.
Well, thanks so much. I'm sure there's some people who are going to have a few questions for Justin, and we've got a microphone out there. So if you have an insightful question, put your hand up and we'll bring a mic around.
Your songs are quite personal and specific, and some artists try and separate the art from the individual. I was just wondering if you think like that's sort of a futile division, and that part of being an artist is like involving or sharing bits of your life with a broader spectrum of people.
I think it is. It is a good. I mean, it just depends on what kind of relationship you want to have with your followers, I think. I do find that, like, the personal, my songs hit very personal notes, but I never just hang my laundry out to dry. I always use composite characters, you know, and things like that. I think that it's, as an artist for me, I feel that it's definitely a must, something that's, but it's something that I have to do, but I also think that it's something that's very difficult to do, because there's a really big difference between a song and a diary entry. And that's what a lot of people have trouble with when they start dealing with personal things. It's just like this moaning, droning diary entry, you know? And that's the trouble that comes with personal songs, is sometimes you gotta watch. There's a very fine line between personal and too personal, you know, you have to be very careful of it. And I think that's why I'm such a slow kind of a methodical songwriter. I mean, I'll sit and write on a song for 6 months. I started Harlem River Blues 8 months before I finished it, like the day before we walked into the studio to record the record, you know. And so that's, you know, I have to make sure that, I mean, I have to watch myself carefully to make sure that I don't go overboard with the personal touches, you know?
Is there a fast one more? Is there any songwriters or poets that you look to as, like, good sort of models for walking that line between personal and songwriting?
Yeah, I always think that, like, for a writer, I think Truman Capote had a very great ability to involve his personal life in his writings, but still kind of come out clean, smelling like a rose, you know, kind of thing. You know, and I think that that's really that, and I tell you who's a really great one at doing very personal songs is Shane McGowan. You know, it's like, you know, he knows how to. You know, he knows how. First, he is the absolute best at just like. I mean, I've watched like grown, just tough, ugly men cry at Shane McGowan's songs, and that's it's because he knows how to hit them personally, and then, you know, then just reel it back in before they know too much.
Hi, Justin. It's so nice to see you here. And your new album has just blown me away. I downloaded it the day it came out and got to play it on the radio, which was really exciting.
Thank you.
The question I want to ask is, who have you seen at this festival that you've really been inspired by?
I actually haven't seen a show. Because I'm actually staying in Byron. And so my idea was the beach. So any time that I haven't been on stage, I've been on the beach. it's been a cold winter back in the States.
You were saying before you're a big fan of Dawes, though.
Dawes, yeah. Dawes is I met those guys a year and a half ago or something like that, and they've become. If you can catch Dawes, they're one of the most incredible bands I've ever seen. Like, they're one of the best bands in America without question. And they're young and they're just getting started. So, you go check them out, because I got a feeling it's gonna grow for them, and yeah. And you could know about them when.
Except they're playing at the same time as you this afternoon, so don't check them out this afternoon. we're gonna have to let Justin go because we've got to get off the stage and let the next act on. But thank you so much, and you can see Justin this afternoon at 5 o'clock at the Crossroads, and I advise that you do. Thanks again.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you.
You've been listening to a Rhythms podcast from Bluesfest 2012, produced by the media students of Southern Cross University.